Hey friends, well, it's been a while since I've posted, way before the quarantine actually, so I feel like a lifetime has passed since my last episode of Seminary Dropout. You know, that's partly because my life, like yours, has changed a lot since this quarantine. My day job has slowed down drastically, and also my kids' schools are not meeting. So I've kind of gone back to being a stay-at-home dad for the last, 5 weeks now. And I assume that your life has changed a lot too. So it's prevented me from being able to post episodes of Seminary Dropout as much as I'd like. I actually have a pretty good backlog of episodes to publish, but I just haven't gotten around to posting them. Listen, I just wanted to drop in before this episode and do a little check-in since the world has so drastically changed since I last posted, since we last checked in. I hope you're doing okay. I know that most people are hurting in some way, whether it's just going stir crazy from being in the house so much, or you've lost a job, or just maybe not your job completely, but lost income, kind of like myself. Or maybe you've actually had someone close to you that's gotten sick and maybe even died from the coronavirus. I just want to give my sympathies to anyone out there who's given a loss. I just want to give my sympathies and my prayers to anyone who's had a loss throughout this. Any of those losses, jobs, income, lives. It's all legitimate loss and needs to be grieved. So my only advice would be to tell you that God is with you. That doesn't mean it saves you from pain, but God is with you in that pain. Otherwise, please listen to doctors and listen to the majority opinions in the medical field. You can find one doctor that will tell you anything. Please listen to what the majority of epidemiologists and doctors and the people in the medical field, what they are saying. Please be safe. Remember that part of following Jesus is living a selfless life. So we're quarantining, not just because of ourselves, but for the sake of our neighbors, especially our elderly neighbors and our immunocompromised neighbors. That is why we do that. So anyway, look, I would love to hear from you, whether that's an email or a tweet or something on my Facebook page. How are you doing out there? Would love to hear from you. So anyway, I hope that these episodes of Seminary Dropout, that they would be an escape, but in the best way. Escape that puts us in touch with the image of God in people around us. And so, no, these episodes are not going to be about the coronavirus or those kind of relevant things, but they are about life, about Jesus. And so I hope that you benefit from them as always. Okay, thanks. Here's the episode. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest, Ronald J. Sider, is the founder and president emeritus of Evangelicals for Social Action. He is the author of more than 30 books, including Nonviolent Action, The Early Church on Killing, Just Politics, The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, Good News and Good Works, and the best-selling Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger. The new book is If Jesus is Lord, Loving Our Enemies in an Age of Violence. Dr. Sider, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
I know that you are a part of the Mennonite denomination. Is that a tradition that you grew up in?
Yes. Actually, Brethren in Christ is a part of that larger Baptist Mennonite family. But yes, my wife grew up an Amish Mennonite.
Many of our listeners are familiar. We've had Brooksy Cavey on the podcast several times, who's a part of the Brethren in Christ denomination in Canada. So we got some.
Brooksy's a good friend. I grew up in Canada.
Yeah, we love Brooksy and his teachings. I wonder, for those who aren't familiar with your work, I wonder if you could just discuss maybe some of your other writings, specifically Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger, which I mentioned was a best-selling book. That may be the one that people know most of.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a farm, first person to go to college. I was privileged to get a good scholarship to do a PhD at Yale. And at that point, I thought I was going to be an academic. But God took my life in a different direction. Lived in the inner city, then an interracial section of Philadelphia. And I had a strong sense of call from while I was still doing my graduate studies to help evangelical Christians develop a more powerful concern for justice, racial justice, economic justice. And that's been central to my life. I was determined that to the extent that I had anything to do with it, it would be a balanced concern, not just spending all the time on social justice, but equally concerned with evangelism. But my best-known book is Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. And basically what I tried to do there was, first of all, to describe poverty in the world and then to describe our affluence and then go back to the Bible. That's always my method. I see a problem, then I want to ask what biblical teaching is relevant to that. And I have four chapters on what the Bible tells us about God's concern for the poor and economic justice and an understanding of wealth and so on. And then I ask, okay, what can we do? And I talk about what the church can do to overcome poverty, what individuals can do, and what we need to do in terms of changing our systems, our structures, our laws, and our global policies.
A lot of people like myself, a lot of believers, we read the Bible, we read the words of Jesus, and we come to an understanding that Jesus taught nonviolence. And we see that in the words in the Bible. And that's great. And then we have to turn around and live a life in the world here and now. And it seems as though those words are extremely impractical and completely counter to the way the world works. And this new book, If Jesus is Lord, is really a deep dive into that, into, first of all, objections from within the text that people have to claims that Jesus taught nonviolence, and then real world challenges. You know, how does this work? How could we really function if we actually swore off violence completely? And I wonder what made you decide that that was an endeavor you wanted to take on?
Yeah, you know, Shane, I get it. I get the just war argument. At the best, you know, just war Christians really want to follow Jesus. They care about justice and peace in the world. And it's simply true that evil, vicious dictators, Stalin, Pol Pot, Hitler, ISIS, you know, swagger through history, and they do awful things. And it looks like the only way to stop them is to try to kill them. I understand that, but my bottom line is, if Jesus is really God in the flesh, if he's true God and true man, as Christians have believed for 2,000 years, then we can't say, Jesus, yes, you taught nonviolence, you taught us not to kill, but sorry, it doesn't work in our world, we'll have to ignore you. That's just not acceptable. I think it's finally a Christological heresy. I mean, if Jesus is God in the flesh, then what he told his disciples to do is what Christians must live. You know, Reinhold Niebuhr, one of the greatest American kind of public theologians, was famous on this. And he said, yes, Jesus said we're supposed to be totally loving toward everyone, including enemies, but it doesn't work in our world. So sorry, Jesus. He could do that because he really didn't have an Orthodox Christology. He didn't really believe in the deity of Christ. Mm-hmm. But if you believe in the deity of Christ, it seems to me you just can't do that. But, you know, Shane, I think the strongest argument against my position that Christians are never supposed to kill is that it looks like people like myself are ignoring our obligation to love the neighbor, that we're simply standing passively by the side. Gandhi is famous for saying that if the only two options are to do nothing when somebody attacks the neighbor or to kill, then of course we should kill. But his point and my point is there's always a third option. Yeah. We can always intervene nonviolently. And in the last 50, 75 years, we've seen more and more and more examples of successful nonviolence. Dr. King changed American history. Gandhi finally won against the British Empire. In the Philippines, a million people came out into the streets, stood in or prayed before the tanks, and they overthrew a dictator. Same thing happened with communist dictators in Poland and East Germany in 1989. A dictator in Liberia in the early 21st century. More and more successful nonviolent campaigns. And in fact, there's a book recently published by Columbia University Press that studies about 300 violent and nonviolent campaigns. And they discovered that the violent, nonviolent campaigns, against injustice, for freedom, and they discovered that the nonviolent campaigns were twice as likely to succeed as the violent campaigns. So it's not true that there are only two options, kill or do nothing. There's always a third option, and the historical evidence is that, in fact, nonviolent intervention works again and again.
It sounds like part of what you're saying is that we, as Christians, we have this obligation to start with Jesus and the words of Jesus and then figure out how to live that out, rather than seeing what we think is practical in the world and then going back and trying to conform Jesus' words into that practicality.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we say that the world is full of adultery, so sorry, Jesus, we can't live what you taught about
it's just the way it is.
Sexual fidelity in this kind of messy world, or the same thing about any number of issues. We can't say that about his teaching to love our enemies either.
Let's start with the text, because as I mentioned, there are plenty, obviously. I think in Christianity today, we would be the minority believing that Jesus taught nonviolence. So let's go to the text. I think that most of the reasoning from the Bible for nonviolence comes from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, where he says a lot of eye-raising things, not the least of which is to not resist an evil person.
Yeah, I think it's crucial, if we're going to understand Jesus, to remember the context. Central to that is that at this time in Jewish history, the 100 years around the time of Jesus, there was intense expectation for a violent messianic figure who would come and lead in a war against the Romans and defeat the oppressors. And at this time, there were a number of messianic claimants and violent revolutionaries that said they shouldn't cooperate with the Romans, they should kill them. And that kind of movement, as we know from Josephus, the Jewish historian, led eventually to the Jewish War and the destruction of Jerusalem in 66 to 70 AD. Jesus comes along, says, "I am the Messiah." Well, one more crucial background. Jesus' gospel is the good news of the kingdom. He said the messianic kingdom is breaking in, and that's both a new right relationship with God in forgiveness of sins, because he died on the cross for us, and it's also a new socioeconomic relationship where everything is being transformed. Not completely. It's already begun. It's not complete, but it's that new messianic kingdom that's arriving. Jesus came, said, I'm the Messiah, but he totally rejected the violent Jewish revolutionaries' approach. Now, it's simply not true, Shane, that Jesus just talks about personal relationships. You know, Jesus says, it's been said, but I say to you, and he talks about oaths, and Jesus forbids oaths. I mean, that's a part of public civil life. And the Old Testament clearly commanded people to take oaths. Jesus rejected it. Even more striking, Jesus said, it's been said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you, you know, love your enemies, don't resist evil. And an eye for an eye was the central principle of Near Eastern jurisprudence, central principle of the whole legal process. And that's true of the Old Testament. Again and again and again, the Old Testament commands an eye for an eye, an arm for an arm. Jesus just rejects that. When he says, don't resist, that word is often misunderstood as referring to passivity. Mm-hmm. Now, if he meant never resist evil, then Jesus contradicted himself. He denounced the Pharisees. He resisted them. When he overturned the money changers' tables, he resisted evil. Jesus regularly was resisting evil, but never violently. And if you look at a careful dictionary to look at what that word in the Greek, which is translated do not resist, means, it means overwhelmingly, it's used in the Greek Old Testament and in Josephus to refer to violent military kinds of conflict. Jesus is saying, don't do that. He's really saying, don't do what the violent Jewish revolutionaries are saying that we should do. And when Jesus says, you know, instead of resisting violently, turn the other cheek, yeah, that's a one-on-one. But when he says, carry the soldier's baggage a second mile, that's very much public policy, specifically dealing with the Roman oppressors. It was legal for the Roman legions to demand that colonials like the Jews, who were under their colonial rule, they could legally demand that somebody carry their baggage 1 mile, but they couldn't demand a second mile. And Jesus is saying, so different from the Jewish revolutionaries, but he's talking about public policy, if you will. He's saying, when they demand that, surprise them and carry it the second mile. That's something very public. It's not private. It's not individual. It's like an eye for an eye at the center of Jewish jurisprudence. So it's simply not true that Jesus is just talking about one's personal life, one's private life in the village or whatever.
Well, something that you're hinting at was something I really appreciated in the book, which was this idea that Walter Wink had put forward, which was saying that those discourses were essentially lessons in creative nonviolence. So he kind of talks about this idea that to strike someone on the right side of their face requires you to, with your right hand, use the back of your hand, which was, during that time, a very insulting, degrading kind of thing that you would only see, like, towards masters towards slaves and things like that. And so when Jesus is saying to turn the other cheek, that is, you're putting your left cheek forward. And so it causes a person to either strike you as an equal or to not strike you at all. And then you mentioned the rule about carrying someone's baggage. And so it was codified that a Roman soldier could command somebody to carry their bags for a mile, but only a mile, and they could get in trouble if they did it for longer. And so Jesus was telling them, do it, take that bag for a mile, but then do it another mile, because it causes embarrassment and can even get them in trouble. And they would have this scene of perhaps a Roman soldier begging these Jewish people perhaps to give them their bags back. And so the power dynamics had flipped in that situation. Same as with, he talks about if someone sues you for your outer garment, give them your inner garment as well. And so the kind of picture we have is someone kind of in a court setting disrobing, which causes shame to not the person, but the people around them as well. So Walter Wink, and I didn't realize that he was the one who kind of put this forward and developed this, postulates that that's what's going on here. And I'd heard that preached before and taught, and I thought, well, it seems plausible and that's nice, but I wonder if that's, I don't know if I buy that's really what's going on. And I think you laid it out nicely because it's not for sure that that's what's going on, but it is definitely something that's plausible and worth considering. Did I get that right?
Yes. And that's what I would say. I think it's very, very plausible, even stronger than that. It's quite likely that's what Jesus was talking about. But I don't think we have, enough evidence that we can say with absolute certainty that's right. But that fits with what Jesus was doing. Jesus clearly never resisted violently, but he resisted evil all over the place. He condemned the Pharisees in very sharp language. He told the church to deal with evil in their community. He didn't say, in the church, don't resist sinful persons. He said, deal with them, and even put them out of the church, finally, if they won't listen to what the body is saying. At the trial, interestingly, he was slapped inappropriately on the cheek, and he didn't turn the other cheek. He said, hey, what did I do wrong? If I did something wrong, tell me. But if I didn't, that's not appropriate. It was, in effect, a complaint against police brutality, in effect. So Jesus, in fact, lived in his life the kind of nonviolent challenge to evil that Wink is talking about in those three instances.
And so at the very least, even if Walter Wink is not correct on the specificities of what's going on there, Jesus is very, at the very least, still teaching nonviolence, because he's still saying not respond violence with violence.
Yeah, and the rest of the New Testament, fits with that. There's no long extended passage that deals with it explicitly, but peace is all through the New Testament. Romans 12 has pretty clear echoes of Jesus' statements about not resisting violently. Paul says, don't seek revenge, leave that to God. God punishes evil in God's time. So I think it fits in the book of Revelation. I think it's 25 or so times, I'm not sure exactly how many, Jesus is referred to the Lamb who was slain. And God conquers evil by the cross. Amazing, just absolutely amazing.
It seems further proof that the early church pre-Constantine seems to overwhelmingly believe that to follow Jesus is to be nonviolent. Did I get that right?
In order to get to this book, If Jesus is Lord, I felt I needed to do two other books first. I needed to, first of all, be really clear what the early church, up until the time of Constantine, said about killing. And then I also wanted to talk about the success of nonviolence, because I think probably the strongest critique of pacifists is that they don't take responsibility for history. We don't seek to defend the neighbor. And there's just lots of evidence that that's not true and that nonviolence works. But in the first book, The Early Church on Killing, I collected, and it was the first time anybody had done this, in spite of the hundreds and hundreds of articles and books on the early church and killing, but I collected everything extant, everything that we now have from the early church that relates to killing up until the time of Constantine, who in 313, as emperor, made the Christian faith legal. And every single time that those writers talk about killing, they say, no, Christians should not do that. And that applies both in our personal lives and our public lives. It applies in our personal lives with abortion and infanticide. They say, no, Christians should not do that. And it applies in our public life in terms of capital punishment and in terms of war. So every single time the early church talks about killing up until Constantine, when they talk about it, they say Christians should not do that. After Constantine, that began to change. And by the time of Augustine, 100 or so years later, you know, the just war theory was emerging, but not in the first 3 centuries.
So for those not familiar with that conversation, can you just talk briefly about what is the big deal about Constantine? Why Christianity seems to really be split between pre and post Constantine. And can you, for those who just don't know the story there, well, what happened?
Yeah, well, you know, for the first 300 years, up until 313, when Constantine issued the decree that made all religions legal, and Christianity was among them, up until that time, Christians were persecuted. What they knew, what the Roman law knew about Christianity was that the leader was a political rebel and got crucified as a threat to Roman power. The sign on the cross said, King of the Jews. That meant that he was crucified because he claimed to be Messiah, and that's a political threat to Rome. And sometimes the persecution was terrible. Sometimes it was less severe. But all through that period, Christians were persecuted with some frequency. They were killed. Many, many, many Christians were killed in those 200 plus years. And, you know, I understand how when suddenly, in fact, it happened rather abruptly, because in the first decade of the fourth century, that is 312, Diocletian was engaged, the emperor was engaged in probably the worst persecution and killing of Christians at any point in this whole period. And suddenly, you get an emperor who grants freedom. You know, I can imagine they were absolutely delighted and grateful. I think they failed to remain faithful to Jesus as they dealt with that new situation, but I can certainly understand why they were grateful for their new freedom. Within 100 years of Constantine's decree, only Christians could serve in the Roman army. Hmm. St. Augustine, you know, really felt obliged. He was, St. Augustine died in about, I think it was 430. He was probably the first really significant person, along with Ambrose of Milan, to develop what became the just war tradition. And he wanted to take Jesus' command to kill, Jesus' command to love our enemies seriously. And he said you could love your enemies even as you kill them. But then he admitted that that's not an outward act, an external act. It's an inward disposition. Mm. So you can have an inward disposition of loving your enemies as you kill them. That strikes me as not exactly what Jesus meant.
Am I right in thinking that Christians went from being a persecuted minority to actually, when Constantine comes to power and has his conversion or whatever we want to call that, that actually not only are they not persecuted, but have a degree of privilege where they are?
Not immediately, and that developed over time. But from Constantine on, with very few exceptions, the emperors were Christian. So increasingly, Christians were given advantages. It was socially advantageous, increasingly, to be a Christian, which is probably one reason why large numbers became Christians, you know, when it's in your economic and social self-interest to be a Christian, rather than a situation where you're likely to get persecuted or even killed because you're being a Christian, you can see how more and more people would claim to be Christians.
So I remember in The Naked Anabaptist, Stuart Murray talks about how before Christians are, like I said, they're a persecuted minority, and then they're given, you know, jobs from the empire to protect territories, to, you know, look out for the best interest of the empire. And then that's when Christians all of a sudden start going back to look at the Old Testament to find justifications for using force and violence.
You know, I think the greatest temptation of Christians through all of the centuries is to slowly conform to surrounding culture rather than follow Jesus. One can see that in the last 50 years in American evangelical circles, as we simply succumbed to the surrounding culture's embrace and acceptance of easy divorce. And as a result, evangelicals have gotten divorced at about the same rate as everybody else in the culture. I mean, that's a terrible failure to follow Jesus. It shows how powerful surrounding culture is. And that was going on, you know, after Constantine declared all religions free. It's not easy to follow Jesus when the cultural setting is on the other side, but that's what genuine biblical faith is all about.
Well, let's look again at some scripture, because you spent a good deal of the book looking at the verses that people actually use to say that Jesus didn't teach nonviolence. Most of those have to do with Jesus and some of the disciples' interactions with soldiers. So like in Matthew 8, 5 through 13, and Luke 7, 1 through 10, they tell this story about Jesus' interaction with the soldier. Jesus commends his faith and then, you know, obviously says nothing to him about nonviolence and says nothing to him about quitting his role, his job as a soldier. And then in Acts 10, we've got Peter baptizing the house of a Roman centurion, and there's nothing mentioned about a vocation change or Peter calling him out on violence.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. First of all, the argument is a total argument from silence.
Yes.
There's absolutely nothing in those texts that says that Jesus or Peter said that the profession of the soldier is fine. It just doesn't talk about that. I could claim that Jesus and Peter went on to tell them afterward, but it's not in the text, that they were not supposed to continue as soldiers. But that's an argument from silence, just as the other one, and arguments from silence have no weight. The second comment is that the emphasis in each of these instances, Jesus and Peter especially, is on the faith of the centurion, and on the fact that even non-Jews get to express faith and to become part of the people of God. And whereas the Jewish revolutionaries were saying we should fight against and kill these Roman oppressors, the story of Peter is saying God is embracing precisely Roman centurions and Roman oppressors and inviting them into the people of God. You know, it's also true that it's sometimes said, put it this way, that we were told to pay taxes, and taxes supported the Roman military. But taxes also supported the gladiatorial contests in the arena, which were vicious, terrible things. They also supported pagan Roman worship. And surely just the paying of taxes doesn't mean that pagan worship is fine. And also, a Roman centurion would have to have been a leader in pagan Roman worship activities. That was part of his duty as a centurion. There's nothing in the text that says that the centurion, after he's baptized, is supposed to stop leading pagan worship among his troops. But does anybody think that because there's silence about that, that it was perfectly fine, and that Peter thought it would be perfectly fine for the Roman centurion to go on engaging in and leading pagan worship? I doubt it. It's an argument from silence that just bears no weight.
Jesus cleanses the temple. Luke tells us he uses a whip. We know that he turns some tables over. Some would see that as a violent action, but you say no.
Yeah, well, some of the, first of all, there were two different military troops right there in the temple. The Romans had, I think, hundreds of Roman troops just down up a staircase from where this would have taken place. And the Jews also had armed folk there. If Jesus had engaged in any kind of, a violent rebellion, they would have immediately come down and arrested him. But the text makes it clear that he continues to teach in the temple for several days after that. The other thing is that some translations, I think it's of the John passage, make it sound as if Jesus used the whip on the people. But when you do a careful exegesis of the Greek words, it's clear that Jesus uses the whip on the animals, mm-hmm. and only the animals. So I consider that a marvelous example of the kind of activist nonviolent action that I think all people who refuse to kill their enemies should be engaged in. We should be actively confronting evil. Jesus did it in the temple, didn't use the whip on people, certainly didn't kill anybody. But he confronted what was clearly wrong, both the taking over of the place where the Gentiles were supposed to worship. It was the court of the Gentiles where they were selling the animals and all. And also they were apparently unscrupulous in their financial dealings. And Jesus condemns both.
There are other passages, but I want to just tell people, direct people to read the book because you deal with them very well. I want to talk about the kind of biblical pacifism that you advocate. You feel like the church has a central role in that. And I thought that was a really interesting point to make that I didn't see coming. What do you feel like the church has to do with this?
Well, in fact, in my second book, Nonviolent Action, the subtitle is What Christian Ethics Demands, But Hardly Any Christians Have Ever Really Tried. In that book, I argue not only that nonviolent action has proved successful again and again and again. For example, in India, that campaign for independence, I think about one person out of, 400,000 people died. In Algeria, where they had a violent campaign for independence against France, one person out of 10 died. So, nonviolence works. And what I say in the Nonviolent Action book is that both just war Christians and pacifists have an obligation from their own ethical position to greatly expand the use of nonviolent action and explore what all we can do with that. Just war people, after all, say that war must be a last resort. Well, how can you say you've explored up to the last resort in a reasonable way, if we now see that nonviolence works again and again and again, and you haven't really invested any time or money into that? So just war people, by their own tradition, they don't have to give up the just war view, but by their own theory, they're obligated to work massively in a new way to explore how much we can do through nonviolence. And I want to say to people like myself, and my tradition that thinks we should never kill as Christians, that if we're not willing to put ourselves in the way of danger to engage in courageous activist nonviolence, then we have no right to claim that that's what Christians should do. So both pacifists and just war Christians should be engaged in much, much more extensive exploration of nonviolent action. And in fact, mainline churches, the National Association of Evangelicals, public policy document for the health of the nation says that we must explore nonviolent action. The Catholic Church has made very important statements in official documents about that. So there's a new interest across the Christian spectrum in exploring what can be done through nonviolent direct action.
So that idea that there's a third choice, I mean, that becomes particularly glaring when you look at recent conflicts that the United States has chosen to engage in, where they are unforced errors most of the time. I think of our conflicts in the Middle East, where we responded disproportionately. Even, you know, going back to Vietnam, it seems like a lot of that was to protect an economic interest, and often in cases of pride. Several months ago, I watched the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, which was just devastating to watch. So someone like me that was born after Vietnam had only had a cursory knowledge of it. It seems like it was something we entered and stayed into simply for a long time, simply because of American pride, that America couldn't be seen as losing a war or backing down from a fight. And so it seems like at the very least that just war attitude of finding other alternatives would take us out of the majority of conflicts that we've been in as a country, as far as our government goes.
Now, I think that all of American citizens, just war people and pacifists, appropriately apply the just war criteria to proposals for going to war that we get from the government. That's the official position, not just of Christians, but you know, the military tends to think in terms of that framework. So it's appropriate for us to apply those criteria. And I think you're right that if we really apply those carefully, there would be far, far fewer wars that we fought.
And then I don't know what you think about this, but in the instances where the rare instances where it wouldn't be possible to change things, I think of, you know, home invasions, things that are incredibly rare, but do happen. It seems to me that Christians are never allowed to take martyrdom off the table. And I feel like we are a generation of Christians who have taken martyrdom off the table. We say, no, we will do anything to prevent our own lives being taken or the lives of others. And again, it comes back to who we trust for our life, and are we willing to lay it down for everybody around us?
Yeah, oh, I think that's right. Interestingly, St. Augustine, I said he was one of the, probably the first major theologian to develop the just war criteria, but he was very explicit. He said that in our individual lives, we must not kill to protect ourselves. It's only when government authorizes a just war that it's okay for Christians to be engaged in that. But back to the personal, you know, I would, if I were to face a situation where somebody was coming at me with a gun, intending to do awful things to my wife or child, what I hope, what I've thought about in terms of such situations is this: I would say, stop in the name of Jesus. And then I would leave it to the Lord. I think with some frequency, the person would be surprised and they would stop. Mm-hmm. I suspect sometimes they wouldn't. in the first two centuries when Christians refused, when their leaders all said they shouldn't kill, they got killed with some frequency. God also protected them in some amazing ways. So, and it's also true that the blood of the martyrs led to amazing increase in people becoming Christians in those first two, three centuries.
Yeah, I think we get the script wrong. I've seen the bumper sticker and the phrase that the only two people that gave their lives for you were Jesus and a soldier. And boy, I really cringe when I see that, because we confuse giving our life with taking one. Now, I think many soldiers are very altruistic and brave and self-sacrifice, but Jesus did not take a life for us. He gave a life. And right. and it seems like that we need not confuse that. We get something very wrong when we confuse that.
In fact, Romans, Paul in Romans says that Jesus died for enemies. God loved his enemies at the cross. And if that's the way God deals with enemies, letting the sun and the rain shine on them even when they act in ways that are wrong, then surely we're supposed to deal with our enemies the same way.
Dr. Sider, this book was lovely, and I hope everyone reads it. Thanks for taking the time to be on the podcast.
Sure. Shane, can I ask you to include my my blog? I'd love people to join up with my blog. It's ronsiderblog.substack, ronsiderblog.substack.com. ronsiderblog.substack.com.
Absolutely. And I'll include a link to your blog on the show notes for this show for if anybody wants to. If they forget, just make your way to the show and I'll include a link there. Yeah, I would love for people to check that out. Yeah, thanks so much for offering that up.
Sure. Good to talk, Shane. Bless you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.